Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lau. Well, today we're starting a new series for new game masters. And we'd like to look at different situations that game masters in general encounter, but in particular, new game masters, and just some tips on how to overcome them. But if you're a new GM or you're thinking about being a GM, please listen and we'll have some good advice on what you can do, and in particular in this episode, what you can do in preparation for your first session.
Yeah.
Yep.
So what we'll do is just a general tip. So these are the common things to consider, potential pitfalls and goals. So when planning a session, where do you start?
Well, of course, the first thing you would pick is the game system. You know, something or I guess the genre. There's something that has attracted your attention to this game. And I don't know why I keep saying your. I'm just going to say me because I'm talking about the way I do it. So, yeah, whatever has attracted my attention to this game, whether it's something about the system or something in the setting that I think is interesting, that's what I'm going to want to highlight in the first session, and kind of with the first scenario, when the characters all get together and kind of begin the story that you're hoping to tell. Mm-hmm. So from whatever has interested me about this game, I then do an elevator pitch to the players, and, you know, hopefully they'll be on board. Then I start to get a feel for, or directly ask, in most cases, what type of characters the players would like to play in this game that I've just pitched to them, and also which type of characters would be appropriate. So there was a lot in there, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think you went over quite a few opening steps there. Yeah.
And now it's time for your first session.
Right. So just break out the dice and play.
Well, that ends the episode.
Yeah.
My unintentional Wayne notes.
I don't think that was the Wayne notes. I think that was the unabridged version. going back to the beginning about choosing a system, obviously people are going to pick a system that they really like.
Mm-hmm.
Some systems are better for beginner players than others, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely choose something that you're familiar with or excited about, because unfortunately the Game Master, or fortunately the Game Master, has to read more than the players.
Yeah.
They have to learn more rules, so...
And that's actually an important point to think of in prep, is that if you are the GM, you got to study that book, because everyone will look to you for the answers to the rules.
Right. Yeah. Right. No, that's a really good point, Lyle. I think in either case, familiarity with the system or being really enthusiastic about the system is going to make your job as GM easier. Because if you know the system well, then you won't really, you know, have to consult the book to deal with rules problems, and you know, yeah, you won't be stressing as much. Or if you're really enthusiastic about the game or the setting, that enthusiasm will get you through kind of, you know, the initial mistakes. And, you know, because let's face it, you know, after you're running the game, you go back and you're like, oh, well, I got this wrong, I'm not sure about that. And sometimes that can, I guess, break the spirit of a game a little bit or make you not want to continue. So if you're really enthusiastic for either the setting or the system, that would help, you know, kind of smooth those over.
And the more people at the table who are enthusiastic is the better, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I would think 9 times out of 10, you should opt for the system that you're familiar with, so you can focus on the ins and outs of game mastering. The only time I would suggest allowing your enthusiasm to take over is perhaps if there's a game that you want to try and no one else has played, so you're actually being the pioneer or introducing it to everybody, because everybody would be at your level.
Hmm.
Or slightly lower, because they would not have necessarily have the book.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But then it does put a lot of onus on you to know the material. And again, that can be a pretty steep learning curve to learn how to game master, as well as learning the rules for a new game. So, yeah, I would really suggest going with something that you're familiar with.
Hmm. Yeah, I agree. I assumed when I said it, the enthusiasm, that it was a new system that no one at the table had played yet, and you were, presenting it to the group. But if that's not the case, then you run the risk of, I don't know, having other people correct you, and then, you know, getting stuff wrong at the table where other people call you on it is kind of a downer. So
Well, hopefully most players will do it in a helpful manner.
yeah, indeed, hopefully. But, like, if everyone else has played GURPS and you're like, oh man, I really want to run this GURPS game, but I've never done it before, you know, then the three of your players are like GURPS masters, maybe do something else.
Yeah, so you got that, and then the next step, as Wayne said, was pitching it to the players. Yeah, again, if you choose a system that you're really familiar with, it's probably because somebody else is running it. Hmm. So your pitch is less about getting people excited about the game, because if they're playing it, they probably like the game as well, and just getting people excited about you running the game.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully, or the type of game you're going to run.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are really supportive of new game masters, so that, again, that might not be a problem. But yeah, like Wayne said, of know who's going to be playing and what kind of game they would be interested in, or if there's a particular type of game that you want to play, part of the pitch is explaining what that is. Mm-hmm. So you don't have people who are very social characters showing up for a dungeon crawl, like a very action-oriented game, or you don't have like fighter pilots showing up for a game that's going to take place underwater.
Right.
Yeah. Without submarines, yeah. I'm just thinking of...
Or fighter planes.
No, I was thinking of that Jude Law movie.
That what?
Sky Pilot and the World of Tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, when he goes underwater.
Yeah, with the submersible planes.
I really
liked
that movie.
That was a good movie.
Oh, yeah, that's
that
right.
A good movie.
Was it Captain Tomorrow?
Oh, yeah, Captain Tomorrow. No.
Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow.
That's what it was, Sky Captain and the World of
Tomorrow. I like that movie. Couldn't be bothered to remember
right. I know, same way. Yeah, that's a great movie. What's the title? Something. But
I know Jude Law is in it, Giovanni Ribisi.
Angelina Jolie.
Angelina Jolie.
No, that's a good point. When you're doing the elevator pitch, it's kind of your job as the GM to say what the game is going to be about and what you intend the focus of the game to be. And then it's kind of the player's responsibility to want to join that game, or in extreme cases to bow out and not join, rather than, you know, drag the game down if they're not really that into it. And possibly an entirely different subject about, you know, kind of player etiquette and when it's okay to not join a game.
Or work with the GM and find out, see if there's some kind of hook that he could use to make you interested in the game.
Now, one thing, maybe I'll slightly disagree with you, Wayne, when you talk about what characters the players are going to make.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can also limit what's available to them.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And if it's your first game, that might be something to do rather than say, hey, make whatever. Because then players are going to make whatever.
Right.
And then it becomes your job then to put that all together and plan a scenario. So if you have a really, especially for your first game, walk away with a pretty clear idea of what it is. Even if it's a published adventure, read the published adventure. Say, these are the type of characters that would work well in this game. If it's a mystery, then, you know, people should bring investigative characters.
Mm.
Or if they're not going to bring an investigative character, then they should bring somebody who could be good support and not mind the times that the other players are going to kind of take over.
Mm-hmm. Right. It definitely doesn't hurt to say, in this adventure, we are going to be hunting vampires, or maybe broader supernatural creatures. So bring someone who is able to fight against them, or able to investigate them. Like, these are your constraints. You could have the players construct their backgrounds specifically in a way that would help you out. For example, if you don't want to do the initial group meeting of everyone, you could say that all of your characters already know each other, work that into your background somehow. I don't really care how it is. You can even have players give their characters some kind of motivation that would help you out. Again, maybe you don't need to know each other, but you need to build the characters in such a way that they have a reason that they would want to work with each other.
Yeah, I think especially if you're a beginning GM, I think it's perfectly fine to even give characters or even give players specific backgrounds or characters. I mean, during the elevator pitch of the game, as you said, Chris, you can say, this is going to be a supernatural monster hunting game. I need a character who is X, Y, and Z. I mean, you know, maybe it doesn't have to be all three of those on one character. Or you can just say, among the group, you guys should have this element, that element, and this other thing. So, you know, you can divvy that up however you want, or, you know, one person can take it all. So I think, especially if you're beginning, it's really fine, or it's really okay to limit players' choices so that you're not overwhelmed. Because, as Lyle said, if you go into a game and tell the players that they can build anything, then that's what you're going to get.
Yeah, I just want to be clear when you talked about giving them characters, that you're talking about giving them limitations and restrictions.
Yeah, I was.
Because if you were actually handing out like pre-generated characters, that's going to affect the pitch a little bit, because people won't generally want to create their own characters.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're like, oh, we're going to do this adventure, and here are five, you know, player characters to choose from.
I think pre-gen works well if you're doing some system that's brand new to everyone.
One shot at a convention, that's when they work well.
Yeah. One shots or limited term adventures as well. Yeah. So
what about like half, I mean, maybe getting off topic a little bit, but what about half filled out character sheets? Where it's like, these are the things that are important to the character, or these are the things that are necessary, fill in the rest however you want.
I don't see there'd be that much of a difference between that and pre-gen. Yeah. If you only fill out the mechanical bits, you know, okay, I might want to play an intellectual character, but you put all my points in strength, so...
I like saying, I need these roles, X, Y, Z, and like you said, Wayne, somebody actually could take up two of those roles in one character, so that's really good. And that lets people know also, or gives them more of an idea what to expect with the game.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You're playing a Star Wars game, you say, I need a Jedi.
Hmm.
And I also need a...
Bounty Hunter.
Yeah, okay.
And then everybody steps up for those roles, lickety-split.
How are those guys going to work together? Not sure, but anyway.
Right. No, yeah. I was thinking of the partially filled-in character sheet, because Chris, you brought up, or I think it was Chris, you brought up the, what if people are unfamiliar with the game and the system and the mechanics, and then building a character could be pretty difficult. Especially if everybody is new. I saw kind of like filling stuff in was taking a lot of, burden off of the player who might not know where to put things. Because thinking back to the first time we were discussing Eclipse Phase, like Lyle, I know for a fact you were looking at those seven attributes and saying, I have no idea what these are or what is important. And same thing happened to me when I first started reading it. I'm like, I have no idea what these are because they're not the kind of traditional six that you're used to, and, you know, just kind of sitting down and building a character for a completely new system, people might not know what to do, and then you run the risk of them being unhappy with characters.
I think there's a difference between that and pre-gens, though. You could easily go to your players and say, here's the adventure that I'm thinking of, what kind of a character do you want to build, and then take their idea and do all the mechanical work for them. I think that's perfectly acceptable. But that's quite different than handing them the sheet and saying, here, this is what you're playing.
Yeah, the danger, again, also with, or another danger, is if you do all the work for the players, then once the game starts, then you have an additional burden of actually playing the characters for the players. So they're like, I want to do this, and then you have to go, okay, so what you want to do is...
Yep.
And we've experienced that, where we've definitely wanted to make it easy for a new player to get involved in the game, but perhaps spent or did too much of the preparation for them. So they walked in with a character and they had an idea what it was, but they had no idea how any of the mechanics worked. So every turn they relied on other players or the game master to pretty much tell them what to do, including which die to roll throughout the whole game. And for a new game master, I think that would be an additional burden. So better to like front load that stuff. I certainly see what you're saying, Wayne, like especially in a game like Eclipse Phase. So I guess another advice is don't run Eclipse Phase if you're a new game master.
Right. That actually is pretty good advice.
Don't play Eclipse Phase if you're a new
player.
It's
a great
player.
Game, but not for noobs.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that kind of gets back to the idea of be familiar with the game you're going to run. And that solves the problem.
Absolutely. A lot of the mechanics are covered in character creation. So the players are learning a little bit about the game as they do it. And, of course, a great idea is having people come together and meet to create the characters.
Right.
And then everybody can share the rules and give each other advice on what to do. I think that's pretty good. And it also helps with the time frame. As someone who's making a Rifts character off and on for the last, couple months.
It's taken you that long, huh?
Yeah, I think my name is Mud with them.
Right.
So I'm going to try to make it this Sunday. But yeah, just the fact that I wasn't sitting down with people and making the character, I didn't have a lot of pressure to complete it. And so there's that. But also there's the fact that people can share and help each other in making a decent character.
Yeah, right. If there's any rules you don't understand, then they can help out right there.
And it's also good for you is that you will then pay more attention to what the characters are doing or what the players are doing and the characters are creating. If players create a certain type of character, such as a magic user, that might be a more difficult character to keep track of because they have a lot of different abilities.
Mm.
So if you're involved in the character creation process with the player, then you're going to be more familiar with what their character can and can't do.
Mm-hmm. And furthermore, with what that player wants to do, the kind of characters that are being built, the kinds of skills that are being put into them, then you know, you at least maybe not know, but you get an inkling of where the players want to take this game. And that's really good juice to work into your story.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah.
That's kind of how I go about it. I actually am going way back to earlier, and I was surprised that you said you usually go system first, Wayne. I usually go idea first and then try to find a system that will represent my idea well. But I try not... I'm very heavy on making the a plotted out game, a twine game, as we call it. But I don't like to finish the story before the players are created.
Right, I could see that because, you know, if you finish the... I guess the danger you run is kind of two. If you finish the story or finish plotting things out before the characters are made, then you run the risk of the characters the players make not being appropriate for that game. And then you either have to come up with a new story or you're going to have dissatisfied players. Or I guess the other problem is if you finish the story before the players have made characters, you kind of run the risk of knowing how things, quote-unquote, should end, and then, you know, kind of railroading or driving the characters and players towards that end goal when they may be going or getting there by a different route.
Yeah. So, or not even interested in that end
right,
goal.
Right, or not even interested, yeah. Which I guess is kind of why the elevator pitch is important as well. You can say, you know, this is going to be a game about X, and therefore let's try and focus on that, and that's the main thrust. And if halfway through the game we all agree that we'd be more happy focusing on Y, then okay, we'll cross that bridge when we get there, but let's try and stick to this theme that we put out for now. And I guess just to clarify, like, it isn't always a system that sparks my interest.
Sometimes, sorry, I didn't mean to imply that.
I mean, it often is, but not all the time.
And, you know, I brought it up in the case of a twine game or a pre-plotted out game, but that works in the case of a open story or a sandbox game as well, in that once you get some ideas about what the characters, what the players are building for their characters, then you also have an idea of what kind of things that you should include in the setting, even if you don't have a story planned out.
No, that's a really good point. Like, you know, once you see what type of characters the players have made, that hopefully will bring up a whole bunch of questions as to, like, you know, where they came from, what they're doing, even who they are, and then you can make sure those things are in the setting as necessary. So or even if you're doing, like, a, you know, a very open game where the story isn't plotted out, at least initially, there still needs to be some, you know, kind of conflict right at the beginning that gets the characters involved, and once you see who the characters are, you can tailor that situation so that it makes sense and that the players have a reason to get involved. But I guess something I've heard, I guess recently, was kind of like an in media res sort of thing, where the GM presents a scenario, then kind of ends on like a cliffhanger or a problem or a conflict, and then says, make characters who would get involved in this problem.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, but that's like a just like story seed, or I think it was a Palladium does the hook, line, and sinker, maybe. I think they do that.
Yeah, I think that's theirs, yeah.
Yeah, but it's some sort of hook on that. I'm going to disagree with a little bit with what you guys say. For a first adventure is really, I would say, come with a pretty clear idea what the story's about. Not necessarily the ending, of course, but I wouldn't make it as freeform as some people make a game.
Right, okay.
For your first times, because that means you're always going to be playing catch-up throughout the game, and there could be even the greater danger if the players aren't contributing as much as they could be, then you have nothing to provide them.
Right.
So I think I would come with a fairly strong idea, but I think we all are in agreement is that, a juicy hook, or a real a cliffhanger or something that the players can jump in, because in that first session, that's the time to hook the players.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons why we would recommend, you know, having the players together somehow. Either one of you guys recommended it, where you said just tell the players, hey, you guys got together work together somehow. Just work it in. You have some sort of connection. An alternative is that the first session is about the players getting together, but make that really, really juicy.
Right.
they're linked somehow. So, some things that we've done in the past is there's a murder. One person's the investigator. One person's the prime suspect.
And the other person is some poor schlub who got roped in halfway through.
Yeah. Well, some person wasn't there for the first session. So, so the idea was, okay, you guys are together suddenly. And that actually also was a bit of a surprise for the players. So then it allowed for a cliffhanger in that session. Because then it's like, okay, now we're together. Now what? Right. Another thing that was also tried, I think it was in Wayne's game, everybody had kind of a little bit of amnesia because they're coming from the fairy world. They crashed through a mirror together. Okay, you're together. You've got a problem.
And a golden puzzle piece.
Yeah, yep. You think you have some kind of connection, but you're not really sure. Go.
You got to figure it out together because you're all in the same situation.
Right. Yeah. And then the players tried to bolt at like three different directions, and I'm like, oh, come on.
don't do that.
All right, I was exaggerating.
There's also the traditional route where all the characters start in a bar, and then a bar fight breaks out, and they have to fight together. I'm not necessarily saying that's a great one, but that's the one that's kind of definitive of D&D.
Right. And here's the thing why I'm going to suggest not to do that. I'm not trying to be rude, because that's what a lot of people do, and that's some people try to hand wave getting together. Mm-hmm. But if you can make getting together clever, or force the players to make the connection clever, then that's going to make the game a little bit more memorable, because the players will come with some strong connection, so they're going to have some sort of motivation if they've done it right, and they're going to be excited to kind of show off how being together is going to be good for the game. Or if you do something that's a little bit clever, then people are going to go, yeah, I want to see how this story ends. Because really, I mean, just every story or every movie, it's all about how it begins and how it ends. And there can be a lot of mistakes in the middle.
Right.
But yeah, you want to hook them, not only hook them onto the story, but hook them onto the potential of you as a game master. And I wouldn't, if you're a masterful game master, you can hand wave that tavern stuff. Because everybody's going to, you know, I can't wait till we get to the story, because it's going to be awesome. Because everything she does or everything he does is great. But then when you try to like start hand-waving stuff, okay, you guys are together. And he's like, oh, great. Yeah, all right.
We're together, how? Don't worry about it. Just you.
Yeah. Yeah. You see an old mage comes up to you in the bar and says, you know, the king wants somebody to kill an ogre. Are there some brave warriors here? And everybody's going, ah. Oh. I mean, your players are going to roll their eyes. And like, all right, we'll do this.
Hopefully where you can't see.
Jeez. Well, I think it's one of the more important things. Really set that tone and what you're bringing to the table.
Yeah. So. And really spend some time on that, the player meeting, how they get together. Because I've seen more campaigns end before they begin based on characters who just don't get along.
Yeah, you can hand wave the characters getting together. I mean, the starting with an action scene or starting with an established team of characters is fine, in my opinion, and might be easier given the circumstances or the situation. But I do completely agree with what you said, Chris, where if you do that, you have to be sure that the characters are going to work together. So, you know, sitting down for that kind of group character creation session would be really important if you're gonna do that. And I agree with you as well. I think Chris and I got off a little bit assuming that the GM, you know, maybe more advanced or more established, you know, where we're gearing this towards new GMs. So yeah, doing a lot of improv might not be the best idea. As you said, coming in with that strong idea of what you kind of want the goal of that first session to be, or what you want to highlight, even if it is kind of railroady, is probably the better choice if you're starting out, you know? Like, yeah. If you were going to run like a Musketeers game, say, great, you know, they're already working together. I want the first setup to really highlight that. We're going to do a lot of, you know, kind of political intrigue during this game. So that's what I'm going to focus on during this thing. And make up a little scenario that really highlights that, you know?
Well, one of the ways you could do that is to put them together, but not together. As in, they may all be musketeers of the king, but they aren't the three musketeers yet. They are just three musketeers who have yet to become friends or companions.
Right. So you're three musketeers, but you're not the three musketeers.
Exactly, yeah. And the story of how you become the three musketeers can be the opening.
You are musketeers really who happen to be three in number.
So we're the three musketeers, really? No.
D'Artagnan Wayne?
Yeah. Another thing that you can do, and this not only helps you throughout the game, but can also help you to get people together, is to have one player pull them aside, and they can play a more prominent role. They might have more information than the other players. Obviously, choose a well-liked person, a respected person at the table, and they can even act as a recruiter. I mean, if you're looking at how many movies are there now? But if you look at the Marvel movies, you can have one person act as
Nick Fury.
Nick Fury, yeah, mm-hmm. Who goes around and recruits the other players. And that can even be the first session, is they've got a little bit of information. So they're doing a lot of the exposition for you.
Mm-hmm.
And they go around and recruit the other players. Maybe not make it too spread out where for example, four players are sitting there waiting until they get to where they are. Maybe that one recruiter calls them all together and they do the speech, because then it's all the players are doing everything and, you know, you're just behind the scenes. I mean, you've orchestrated this all.
Mm. Pulling the strings.
Yeah, pulling the strings, yeah. But people are going to remember just how much fun that game was, and you happen to be the game master for that. But what you've done is you've got one player to take on a little bit more responsibility, and people like that, but then that seems more natural, because mm-hmm. when you have an NPC calling them all together, yeah, that seems more of a cliche.
No,
when you get a player calling people together and doing that, then that's less of a cliche.
No, yeah, I completely agree. And yeah, I'm glad you said that, you know, call all the characters together in one central location and then have that, you know, one character do them. Because I'm thinking, like, wow, okay, if it was like the four characters all in different parts of the world, that's going to be a real boring start to the game, where it's just, you know, little one-on-one mini sessions, one at a time. So yeah, don't do that.
If somebody, for example, isn't able to come to the first session, they can kind of have a rolling thing where you, the first Nick Fury character, he meets the Black Widow character, and then during the next session, when the Hulk character can show up, then the two of them go to recruit him together, or something like that. Work with what you got.
No, I like that, because incorporating people later on in the game can be quite challenging. So having that recruiter already implanted means that it's easy to go, look, you've got to get this guy involved.
Mm-hmm.
Or this person involved.
This is your job, yeah.
Yeah, it's what you do, because again, like, okay, this person shows up in the forest, and now they're your best friend. Why? Come on. He's a player.
Right. Yeah, why? He's a player character. Yeah. Just do it. Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes those things happen where you just have to rely on the players to pull a little meta and accept something that would otherwise not make sense.
Yeah, so certainly that's, we've got a couple goals there. One goal is to really hook the players. Another goal is to really lay down what the restrictions or what the parameters are.
Right.
So that people make characters that fall within your game. But of course, yeah, you certainly have some flexibility. So if somebody really wants to play a certain character, that your story can be tweaked.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want the players to feel like throughout the whole campaign, any decision they made didn't matter, because it was all going to come down to this.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then for the first session, one of the major goals is how are the players together, or how do they get together? And another thing that we alluded to is the hook, the cliffhanger, which can be really tough. So what do you guys do when you're sitting down and you're thinking about your first session? What kind of hook or cliffhanger are you guys looking for?
That is a tough but a very important question. I can tell you how I get inspiration. Like, inundating yourself with a lot of media regarding that theme or whatever genre you're going to play really helps me. Like, again, going back to the pulp game we ran, I watched all the Indiana Jones movies, you know, The Rocketeer, Sky Captain of the World of Tomorrow, which title I couldn't remember a while back, you know, watching all of those movies and kind of pulling out what I thought would make a cool cliffhanger or a cool opening conflict or something to get the players involved, because that, as you said before, part of the goal of the first session is to establish like the tone and the mood of the game. And so reading novels or listening to music or watching movies or whatever media related to the genre of game you're going to do, and then, you know, pick, even if it's like a cliche or kind of like a, you know, a well-worn trope from that genre, I would say do something with that, because it may, hopefully the players won't roll your eyes like, oh, this again. But if it's a trope, then that really helps establish the tone and feel of the game.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to build up a setting and to have people immediately be able to connect with it, is using the tropes. In addition to that, I think actually an answer is kind of built into your question there, Lyle, in that the cliffhanger, what kind of a cliffhanger you're going to use. And I don't think that it's absolutely necessary that you end on a cliffhanger, you know, where it's, you know, some kind of monster is barreling down on top of you. But I think you should leave the first session at least open to hint at kind of a larger world or a larger story. If you have that planned plot that's going to be going somewhere, you know, start to drip that into the story, so the players begin to think about what's going on here, or that there's something larger than just meeting each other in the tavern or whatever setting you have set for them.
Okay, for example, if you were running a dungeon crawl, they've got to go to point A, a dungeon, a castle, and they've got to explore it. Where would you want to end that first session?
Generally, we tend to have shorter sessions on the range of 2 to 3 hours. So in a case like that, usually I think that would only be enough time to get the initial characters meeting each other. So I would try to aim for ending it where they're starting off to the dungeon, or perhaps right when they arrive at the dungeon. So you can describe it in full detail, you know, as you open the door and head into the dark and then kind of cut off there. Though, that said, if you're introducing a new system to yourself or to the characters, go ahead and have a fight, you know, get the action pumping in the first session. And also it gives everyone a try at how the crunchy mechanics of the combat work.
I'm going to take a page from Lyle. I actually disagree with you a little bit, Chris, and I'm going to say, regardless of the length of the session, ideally I would aim to end the session with some kind of conflict that really told the players, okay, you can't go back from this point. Whether to pull a you know, cliche, someone steps on a pressure plate in the dungeon and, you know, the stone wall starts grinding down behind them, cutting off the only way they knew how to get in or out of the dungeon. Or, like, some kind of fight that says, okay, there's more going on here than you thought, and it's going to have a big impact in the area. You really need to continue this dungeon delve to get to the heart of it before things get really bad, right? I would want something that says, this is what the game's about, and this thing that just happened is really important to where you're going to want to keep going along this obvious path that I ideally have set up for you. I mean, not railroading, but, I mean, if, worst case scenario, you know, you set them up, the players, where they're just meeting, and now they have to go to the dungeon, they may not, you know? Like, if the session ends with them just kind of getting to the gate, that could be exciting if things are really ominous and something obviously bad is about to happen, where they say, well, we better go check this out. But I mean, that could feel a little bit anticlimactic if they just get to this opening in the ground and that's where we're closing the session.
I really like how you phrase that, and I don't think I could say it any better. Yeah, making sure that at the end of the session, the players obviously want to continue playing, and
yeah, that's important.
In the story, there's no way back. Yeah, we're in motion. Of course, the difference between, like, you know, a total railroad-style game and your game maybe would be that they still have choices to make, but one choice that they can't make is going back.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, the stone wall grinding down behind them was ham-fisted, but I couldn't think of a better metaphor.
Because whether or not it's that stone door closing, or you have the prince of the city saying, "You two solve the crime, or you both die." Mm. I mean, that could be heavy-handed, but yeah, it says that what they're going to do. Or you discover a clue. Mm. They go and, you know, going back to our last episode of with police officers. Oh, we just thought it was going to be just an everyday murder crime scene, but no, what are these markings of Cthulhu? Wow,
Right.
Dun,
right.
Dun, dun.
For the, no, that's a bad example, because anyone who's read Lovecraft is going to go, okay, how about we don't continue, because we all know what's going to happen.
We're going to go back. Guys, come on. Yeah. Come on, there's just lots of things.
which gets back to the elevator pitch of, hey,
guys,
I need characters that are going to keep going, even when you know they shouldn't. Yeah.
There's underlined passages in that book. Come on, just read it.
Hold on, I just realized, is the Necronomicon like the original Rickroll thing where you're like, here's this book. I know I shouldn't read it. Someone's given it to me, telling me, hey, you should really read this. I can't resist. Oh, God, why did I do that?
Wayne's talking about Rickrolling because we were cat-rolling him earlier.
Oh, jeez, yeah.
Posting up links and talking about how they were really cool Lego links and turned up
yeah.
cats playing keyboards. Thank you very much.
That was the best cackle right there.
Anyway,
so
another thing I think that's good to work into the adventure is screen time. Make sure that the different characters and the different players all get a chance to do something and to get themselves invested into the story.
No, that's an excellent point, especially if you're going to do something like the recruiter, because you have a recruiter who's getting boku screen time.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. So making sure that everybody feels special. So it could be, it could be quite hard if you have very divergent characters,
mm-hmm.
trying to squeeze in a task that everybody can do. Okay, this one got a little fast talk here, got a computer to hack, but even presenting them as like really good at what they do, so the recruiters there, they're going to have a lot of flattery.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They can have resistance, but I don't know. It's something about, your brother's in jail. We can get him out of jail if you come along with us and help us. Yeah, so let everybody feel like they're important.
Mm-hmm.
So what does a new game master need to do to actually like prepare for it? What do they need to have ready, either physically or mentally? For the game.
You have pizza ordered when the game starts.
Pizza,
you have pizza ordered.
Ordered. All right.
As I mentioned before, I think one of the biggest things is that you feel good about the rules before you go in. Reiterating, but I think it's worth saying again, is that that you should know the system well enough to be able to run it.
Yeah, following up on that, I would say easy access to the rules in case you do have to refer to them, whether that means having a PDF printed out or the book handy. Make yourself a cheat sheet, both for you and, if you have time, for the players, with common things they might do in-game.
I think that's very specific to something I do, but I find that it helps me out a lot, is that when I'm learning a new game, I write myself up a cheat sheet, and that really helps solidify the rules both in my mind, and it also gives me a nice reference to work with when the game comes to being played.
No, that's really good. And that can also be helpful if the player, if you're going to be the advocate for a certain game and introducing it to people, is that providing a cheat sheet. We did that for World of Darkness and shared it with people because everybody, and unfortunately we didn't do it straight away, but we certainly learned from that, is having like the combat system written out for everybody, even though it's actually written out in the book, but people refused to read it. So wrote it slightly differently. And then writing that out actually helped me learn the rules better because, writing helps you learn.
Mm-hmm.
And you can add to it. Like when stuff comes up, then you just add in one of the rules that you're always accessing.
Right, right.
Yeah, because some of these books, like hundreds of pages, or most of the books are hundreds of pages, and it slows down the game to be flipping and finding out. And if you're not sure what rules are going to be constantly referenced, certainly there's a Game Master screens that you can buy, or you can just ask the players, like, what are the core things to remember?
Yeah, just
what are the tables that I'm always going to be looking up?
Oh yeah, if other people are familiar with the game, definitely. Yeah.
So that's a really good physical thing to have is the cheat sheet. Another thing is to write down a list of the NPCs that the players could possibly encounter in the first couple sessions, and write down something that's at least one or two things that are interesting about that NPC, that can help your characterization.
Yeah,
and again, for setting the tone, it's like was said earlier, is that can help with the game. And like Wayne was saying, like draw on tropes, because tropes can be boring if you're watching, summer blockbuster, but can actually really make something come alive because you're tapping into the genre, like the collective genre's memory, and everybody's going to go, oh, he's a villain. Oh, she's really powerful because they're using these things. She's crazy.
An old man who works in the library? Well, guess where we're going for information.
Right.
And he's black? Oh.
Okay. He knows everything.
No, again, I hadn't really thought of it, but you saying make a list of the NPCs that the players, that the characters are likely to encounter within the first couple sessions is a really good idea, Lyle. And to follow up on that, especially for beginning GMs, if you're coming into the game with a really strong idea of where you want that first session to go, then come into it with notes about, you know, where that game is going to go and kind of what's going on in the setting. Because, yeah, starting GMs, I think you're allowed to be a little more heavy-handed in terms of, you know, kind of railroading the players a little bit and, you know, saying these are the things that are going to happen in the story because this is what the story is about. So by all means, write those things down so you remember and leave space between those things because you're going to be taking notes about what changes because players love to throw monkey wrenches.
Yeah, that's right. You use flowcharts a lot in your games, huh, Wayne?
I did at first, and then I eventually, they helped me get an idea of what some possible things were due to, you know, player interference, I guess. But then you can't plan for what players actually do. I mean,
no, it's impossible.
Yeah, you give them plan A, plan B, and they go with like plan X, you know, that you couldn't have foreseen. So after a while, I just ended up worrying that I was railroading or shoehorning you guys into certain actions by writing them out. And so I just kind of stopped doing that. And it was good. It was good at first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, if that's something that helps you learn, too, then there's no problem with it at all, hey?
Yeah, yeah.
I offer this with a very, very heavy grain of salt, but also some box text might help. Writing out the descriptions of the different places and or people that they're going to meet. We've done an episode separately on it, so feel free to look that up and listen for much, much more information on the topic. But if you have a difficult time in kind of presenting something off the cuff, describing a scene or a character to the players, then by all means, write it out a little bit beforehand. Don't go too long, though.
I'm going to agree with you, but not for the reason you think, because, you know, I hate box text, but I'm going to agree because, as Lyle said, writing stuff down helps you remember, and so you writing out the box text of those NPCs or locations or whatever, you know, would help you get a better handle on them and remember them better, so that maybe you wouldn't have to rely on the text you wrote down as much. So.
You can also get some pictures of the NPCs. And that can help you. So you, if you really want people to walk away with a pretty clear idea of what the world is, certainly the people that populate the world is an important aspect. So when we entered Chris's, in his most recent game, his Pathfinder game, when we walked into the city and we went to the party that we're having, and then we saw all the pictures of the people, then we got a clear idea like who was in the who was in the city, but we also got the way they were clustered and they were at the party. We got an idea of alliances and dynamics using if you have a more sexualized game like a changeling or vampire. It also helps people to become more intrigued into the NPC as you pick an attractive NPC or an interesting looking NPC, and then people are intrigued and they might want to know more about that person, or they might be repelled by that person, and that's what you're going for. So yeah, you can use the power of the picture. Yeah. And it also, again, that also helps when you look at a picture, then you get an idea of what that, it makes that NPC more real for you, so you have a clearer idea of how they're going to act in a situation.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So when you write down a name and a couple points, that's okay. But if you write down a name and a couple points and it's on the back of a picture or it's under a picture, then that's, it's almost, that NPC is almost alive now.
Right, right.
Yeah. And it's going to help you take what's in your head and share it with the rest of the table.
Absolutely. Yeah. Plus, it's a lot more evocative to hold up a picture and say, this is, you know, kind of, this is the person who is talking, rather than having to describe them every single time.
You know, I was, I think when I first became a fan of pictures is when I was really, getting reintroduced into role-playing games, and people were talking about a superhero game and how somebody was very good at drawing comic book characters, like comic superheroes and supervillains, and they drew the villain. And somebody noticed that they seemed to have a metallic belt buckle, and they had electrical power, and they used that to do a clever stunt. And that's really good, and that's something that you might not describe, because you're it's going to be boring if you describe an NPC from the top of their head to the tip of their toe, plus their personality and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But then that picture is that people are like listening to what you're saying when you're, and what it, the villain's saying or the NPC is saying, but then they're also scrutinizing their appearance, just like they do when you meet somebody for the first time.
Right. No, that's a really good point.
You listen to what they say, but then you're visually scrutinizing what you see.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really good. And then I heard it on another podcast called Thaco, and they were talking about what they do with pictures. And I thought, yeah, no, I agree with what they're saying.
Right.
Yeah. All right, so we've got our rule sheet. We've got our NPC list, possibly NPC pictures. I also think it's nice to have a map, and not just if you're doing a dungeon crawl. And it could be a map of the city. It could be a map of the country, or something that, again, helps to make the setting more real.
Okay.
Now, certainly, if you're going to spend a lot of time on a ship maneuvering around it, or in a dungeon maneuvering around it, yeah, definitely have a map, because you don't want to think on the fly. You take a left, you take a right, because players are going to go back.
Mm.
You know, even with the metaphorical stone doors closing, then.
Yeah. And, you know, when we're talking pictures, it doesn't have to be just pictures of the NPCs. Take pictures of the location, too. I think in the recent Vampire game, instead of drawing a map of the sewers that we went down into, Lyle, you got a picture, a bunch of pictures of sewers, and showed them to us, and it really helped to define the experience.
And you guys are like, I take the sewer. No, no, guys, you're there. Okay, but, all right, we take scrapings off the wall.
Right.
Yeah,
well, it must be important. Yeah.
Yeah, with access to the, imagine in the 80s when we had to do this? But
I think we accessed things called books.
We went to the library. Yeah, but now you can just...
What is this you speak of?
Type in sewer into Google, and yeah, it turned out a lot of them were sewer systems in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Small world, I guess.
Thanks to the internet, yeah.
Yeah, but we made them a sewer system in Detroit, which probably was a lot less... cool looking.
Most likely.
Okay, this is what the sewer looked like. I get out.
Yeah.
No, you gotta explore. No.
No, I'm done.
I haven't had my Heptavax. So.
You know, lots of different kinds of props are all really cool, but it's hard to give a specific example for any game. Okay, well, there is one example. When Wayne was doing his pulp game, we were sent to find a missing professor. And one of the pieces of evidence to get file his trail was his journal. So Wayne just got a book, wrapped it in brown paper, tied it up with twine, and presented that to us. Even though there wasn't any writing inside to use, it was still a really cool prop to just have and hold. So, sorry, it's overly general piece of advice, but props are cool.
Yeah, it would have been better if I'd actually put real text in there, because the player who picked it up was thumbing through trying to find the text in there that was, you know, relatable to the game. So... can have a drawback, but yeah.
I spent a lot of time making a detective's notebook. I found online the forensic report, or the pathologist report, and filled that out. Never got used. But
never happened.
But if you're definitely basing that first session around some, like a key meeting or a key piece of information, if you can physically provide that to the players, or digitally provided if you're playing online, and you can post it up, then that gives a lot more weight to what's being said. It gives a lot more weight to the session, and again, it establishes you as a game master, and get people think, damn, you know, that this person knows what they're doing.
Okay, yeah, this guy's got it.
Yeah, yeah. And then they open the book. What? It's empty. What? I mean, Chris had a clear plastic, was it? Or was it actually glass?
It was clear plastic, that rod, yeah.
Yeah, and we were trying to figure out what to do with it. We actually never did figure it out, and he had to show us, but he's showing us how you can use it to read.
To magnify stuff, yeah.
Yeah, to magnify. It was really, that was really cool. So it added to it, even though we couldn't figure it out. But we're like, oh, man, because we found these in the game, this magnifying rod, as well as this really tiny text, because they were... pixies or something like that?
Imps thing, yeah.
Imps, yeah.
No, I think that's what props are. That's the goal of props, to kind of break that wall between player and character, because the character has found this thing that the player now actually has and can manipulate and look at. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now you're ready for your first session. What we like to do in later episodes is to look at other things that can come up when you're running a game. And again, talking about ways to overcome them and different goals to set at different stages in a campaign. So stay tuned for those. And again, these will be pitched for newer game masters. So especially if you're thinking about running a game, stay tuned for those.
And as Lyle said before, if you're an established game master and we got something wrong, well, feel free to, you know, write us and tell us politely, hopefully.
That's what the internet is for.
Exactly. Being polite to strangers.
Right. Right.
Exactly. Everybody's getting it all wrong.
Obviously. Jeez.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com. Outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+. You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, and good luck.
Oh, I wish I'd thought of that.
Nice.
Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-through RPG. The one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.